Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Okay, I'm going to talk again this morning about the Tao Te Ching. Now, 2,500 years ago, there was this gentleman in China who wanted to leave, and he was known as an old philosopher, that's what they called him. And the emperor at that time didn't, they, in order to leave, you had to go through these gates. And in order to go through these gates, you had to pay a tax. So Lao Tzu, wanting to leave, they stopped him, and they knew who he was, and the emperor had put out the word that if anybody saw him, that he was trying to leave, why, they should tell him that he had to write a book before he could. So this, the gatesman there said, well, in order to pay the tax, the emperor would be satisfied with a book, otherwise he couldn't go. So he went into the little gatehouse, and he sat there, and he wrote this book, which is called the Tao Te Ching, the canon of reason and virtue. It has been translated the way. And this is the Taoistic thought, the Taoistic tradition, as it was 2,500 years ago. What it is today is something else again. But at that time, you see, it was extremely valuable for humans. So we are now at the 14th chapter. And it starts with, we look at reason. And he spelled reason, it's a canon of reason and virtue. Reason is used much as the Greeks used the term reason. It doesn't mean to reason about, and it doesn't mean a reason for something. It is just reason, or Tao, the great Tao, that which is the source of everything, reason. This is how the Greeks used the term reason, okay? We look at reason, and we do not see it. Its name is colorless. We listen to reason and do not hear it. Its name is soundless. We grope for reason and do not grasp it. Its name is bodiless. These three things cannot further be analyzed. Thus they are combined and conceived as a unity, which on its surface is not clear, and in its depths, not obscure. And for me, you know, I think that's, it is such a precise way of saying something. You know, on the surface, it's not clear. You know, it isn't. But in its depths, it is not obscure. Now, later on in this thing, anticipating becomes, there is the little verse that says, therefore, let there always be non-being, reason, so we may see their subtlety, these three things. And let there always be being, so we may see their outcome. And their outcome, of course, is this manifestation. Yeah. You know, just to speculate about these words and so on, you know, it doesn't really go anywhere. You know, because if you're speculating about the words, it's like somebody saying, well, let's turn on non-being and let it always be. Or turn on being and let it always be. Which is kind of nonsensical, isn't it? Yeah. Because never the time it was not. So there's all this talk about non-being and being, and then we come to, in this downward swing, you and me. And there is a kind of a response to something, and we don't know what. But we're responding to something. And then as we try to delve into this something, and remembering it is in us, you know, we find that we do have a right. We do have, we could even call it a duty. You can call it whatever you want. But there is that in us, in our sensing of it, in our responding to this something that is bodiless and colorless and intangible, soundless, you know, that we should make some kind of an effort to uncover it. So here, trying to uncover it, where do you find it? Where do you find it? Well, we are using these words, non-being and being, and so we come to the third, and that's becoming, and the becoming is where you find it. And where are you? Where am I? In becoming. We are becoming, always becoming something. See, being is no longer, there's no place to go except non-being, you know. But becoming, we become sad, we become happy, we become busy, we become lazy. We're always becoming something. We become sleepy, we become wide awake, you name it, becoming. And this becoming, this activity in which we find ourselves and which we find in ourselves is the function of this being. So if this being is functioning, then, and I am doing the functioning, then certainly that being also is in me. It can't be someplace way out there and I'm doing its thing way over here. No. And all of this activity all around us, you know, the birds and the bees and the trees and the flowers and the cats and the dogs and the weeds and the grass and the people, you know, you and me. All this, what is called manifestation, all this that is sometimes called the expression of this being. Or you can call it God, or you can call it the Buddha nature, or you can call it Krishna, or you can call it Allah, or you can call it Tao, or you can call it reason. You can call it whatever you want. Because it doesn't care what you call it. But whatever persuasion, you know, whatever tradition you are partial to, they all, each one has its name. And each of the traditions, as I've said before, are simply different ways of, at different times, of talking about something that some have perceived and which all of us should perceive. We should all see what this is, this mysterious reason. And different traditions have been devised at different times for different cultures, but they all point. And if they don't point to that essential, they're not really what we call orthodox tradition. And each of these traditions, each of these different ways of talking about, is a signpost. You know, each is a method, what they call in India, upaya. It's a device to enable us to discover what actually is. You know, one is supposed to use the method of the tradition to find out what this is all about. One is not just supposed to memorize a lot of words and then they think they know what it's all about because the words tell them what it's all about. Words tell you something about more words. That particular method, though, if you're just caught in the words, is not really helping. You know, it becomes in its own way a kind of a hindrance, sort of like, you know. Now, let there be being and let there be non-being. When you speak about it that way, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But in meditation, now, it becomes very significant. Meditation itself is very significant. Meditation is what we would call a upaya. It is a device. It is a means to something. And you practice meditation. Some once in a while, you even meditate. Mostly, we just practice at it. You practice at meditation because you want something. And somebody has said, well, you try this way, and it may be that you will find what you want. Well, what are you finding with your meditation? You're finding, eventually, yourself. Yourself, to know yourself. And then through yourself, when you know the being of this ego self, and then you can come to this unseen God. I mean, it's therapeutic too. I mean, one can sit there and look at all the foibles of the personality and sort of sweep them out of the way, but that's not basically what it's for. It is to know this, to answer the very simple question of who am I? What is this that is aware in me of all this? Now, Lao Tzu says that there are two ways to meditate. Of course, today you can buy books and they say there's 10 ways to meditate or there's 12 ways to meditate. There's all kinds of ways to meditate. But basically, there's two. One is to sit. You know, you sit down in a chair or on a mat or however, you know. You sit with an empty mind. And this is called meditation without desire. And Chuang Tzu, who was the disciple, the very great disciple of Lao Tzu, called this kind of meditation Zhou Wang, which means sit, forget. Sit, forget. Just sit, forget. To sit with what they call empty mind. Sit, forget. Naturally, when you do sit, forget, you forget yourself. Sit, forget. You've got to forget yourself. If you don't, your mind's not empty. You're still in it. And I think most of you are aware by now that the ego self, this that we usually call a self, me, you know, this that comes and goes, is after all, this me is a bundle of desires. You know, in Sanskrit, you know, they call it the kama rupa, the body of desire. That's the ego. It's all the time wanting something. It wants. It wants enlightenment. It wants a new dress. It wants a new hairdo. It wants to get a haircut. It wants all the time wanting. So when one sits with this forget, sit, forget, you forget all these desires. So you forget the ego. So when you can sit, forget, you know, the mind is emptied, as they say. It's emptied of desire and of the impediments. And when it is empty of desire and impediments, it is called a pure mind. Pure mind. A mind that is purified. It's like water. You know, you come to a, you know, the monk and his teacher are walking along the riverbank, you know, and it's in India. And the monk says to the teacher, look at that dirty water. It's full of things. I mean, it's branches and twigs, and it's brown from the mud, and it, you know, pigs are going by it, and people bathe in it, and, you know, it's dirty. And the teacher goes over, and he scoops up a handful of water, and he says, look, that's pure, clear water. There's nothing in it. It's pure. This is what, in a religious sense, is meant by pure. A mind that is purified is emptied of impediments. It doesn't mean that in order to purify your mind, you can only read certain kinds of books, or you can only speak a certain language. I mean, you know, Mr. Impediment in Japan figured none of us could know anything because we couldn't speak Japanese. If you don't speak Japanese, you can't know anything. You know, they see it's not. Some people think that in order to purify the mind and then the body, why, you can only eat certain kinds of foods, and you can only think certain thoughts. You can only listen to such and such on the TV. You can only listen to certain kinds of music. God forbid you should be found listening to rock and roll. No. But this is not a pure mind. This is a prejudiced mind. Yeah. Pure mind simply means all must go. Of course, we realize it's for the moment. The moment you stop sitting, here's all the impediments and desires again. They're not going to run away. You don't have to be afraid of that. Nah. Well, you don't want to give up something, so I can't sit because I don't want to give up something. You do that more often than you know. I mean, after all, if you don't get rid of the desires and the impediments, how else can the mind be empty? If you don't get rid of yourself, this me, I want me. So let us be very careful with this word empty. You know, it doesn't mean to blank out anything. And I have found people try this, and they saw that what they're trying to do is to become unconscious, and certainly that's not it. And it certainly doesn't mean to ignore living. But for a short while, every day, to become quiet, just to be still. And in that stillness, to penetrate into yourself so that you penetrate to consciousness itself. An empty mind doesn't mean that the mind has deserted us. It is simply, and if I can use the term simply, you know, it's mind in its pristine purity. And Lao Tzu used to use water as an illustration. He'd use water in lots of instances. When a water is pure, that is, it has nothing else in it, and it is perfectly still, it has a reflective clarity. And so it's very similar to a mirror. So it is a bright mirror. And Zen uses that term frequently. Mirror mind. When the mind is pure, that is, when it's empty of me, and it is still, it is this tranquil, it's not rushing to go someplace, it's still. It's like a still pond. and it has the reflective ability of a mirror, a bright mirror. And this is the true nature of the mind. It's not the thoughts. The thoughts are the activity of the mind. But the mind substance itself is this bright mirror, this reflective quality. And it certainly is not something you create. It is that now, already. You were born with it. And the more that we can come to this mirror mind, the more we will understand of ourselves and of all of this manifestation. There is a clarity of perception, and it reflects this very essence of Tao. It reflects this reason, and it reflects it so perfectly that it seems as if in this mirror that we are at one with it. The more it is reflected and held and reflected and held, the more the mind takes on the essence of the Tao. And one day then, instead of just reflecting it, then true, we are it. Where we had been encountering, that is, meeting it, we are now that. And what are you then when you are that? This is such a mystery, It is the great mystery. We're on the ground of being, the very ground of being. But it doesn't. But does that tell you? Nothing. There are no words devised that can say, oh. So that's why Lao Tzu always says, this is the mysterious. And he goes on praising the mysterious. Now, the other method of meditation is to use this pure mind. See, it's again, starts with a pure mind, empty mind, a mind empty of self. What is it that they say what Dogen used to say in Soto Zen? To forget the self is to be the self. But there's two different kinds of selves involved. Now, using then this pure mind to concentrate on something, it may be a word, it may be an idea, it may be a particular sound, it may be some kind of an object, it may be some kind of a question. But the purpose of this is to put the mind in a focus, so that it now shines like a flashlight. There are those who say that the mind in focus is able to discern in all of these expressions, all of this manifestation, the Tao. To see reason here. Not just have a concept about it, but see it here, to discern it here. And that the practice of holding the mind in focus, eventually one perceives the Tao itself. So taking oneself in hand, one can see that from time to time, we may alternate with it, but from time to time, we need to practice both methods. A content to focus on and having no content and just sitting. Just sitting. Insight meditation. Just sitting so one has insight into. Now, as I said, Lao Tzu emphasizes the mysteriousness of this reason, this eternal reason, the Tao, this non-being, being, and its manifestation. See, these three. The manifestation springs from being. And being springs from the eternal non-being. So being is of the same nature as non-being, and the manifestation of non-being is of the same nature as non-being. Therefore, having the same nature, we can find out what it is. You know, it's kind of like having the same qualities, the same substance, as it were. It's kind of like tailoring. It's like dressmaking. Huh? Here we have this, all this activity, the manifestations of it, huh? If we're tailoring, we're going to sit there and we're going to cut and we're going to sew maybe lots of dresses, maybe shirts, maybe blouses, maybe suits, you know. But here we have now this kind of manufacturing out of material in all kinds of shapes and sizes. But they are all made of material. They all look different, and they feel different. But every material is composed of what? Where did the material come from to make this, to make your shirt, to make your sweater? Where did it come from? Some other planet? From the devil? Even if it did, it's still from this being, because a being is universal. We make houses, and some of them have thatched roofs, so they're made of grass. Some houses are made out of wood. Some houses are made out of ice. And some houses are made out of bricks, which come from the earth. All the 10,000 things, all the dharmas, all come with this one material. How does this come about? We are all one. How does this come about? And of course, being of this nature, we alternate from the essence to the manifestation, and this manifestation to the essence, and to the essence to the manifestation, and from manifestation to the essence. We do this within ourselves every day, you know, from a unity to a multiplicity, from a multiplicity to a unity. And this kind of an alternation, this cycle, this movement is spontaneous. And it continues, and it continues, and it continues, and it continues. How? Why? The whole thing really is so mysterious. It gets curiouser and curiouser. Huh? Plotinus, who was the principal exponent, he expounded about Neoplatonism, which is a kind of a modern-day Gnosticism. And he wrote a book. And in this book, we find some ideas that were very similar, that are very similar to those of Lao Tzu. And Plotinus in this book says, the perfect and unchangeable life of the divine spirit overflows in an incessant stream of creative activity, always creating, becoming active, which ceases only when it has reached its lowest point. Now, that's, of course, right away. Now we've got a scale. If one puts activity on a vertical scale, you know, then we've got the highest and we've got the lowest. If one puts it on a horizontal scale, we're here and we've got the point furthest out. And they used to have camps by that. Do they still have camps by that name? The camp furthest out? Some religion used to have that, huh? So, but it's like an entropy. You know, you throw a ball
throw a ball.
And it will go as far as the energy that I could put out when I'm throwing the ball. And finally, it reaches its point furthest out and I don't know how far the rays of the sun will extend this energy that it puts out, whether there would be a, what kind of an entropy, or what would be the lowest, or what would be the point furthest out for that, before it would begin, the entropy began to run out. I don't really know. I don't think, do you know? Well, anyway. We all have, because of this source, Plotinus goes on to say, we have that hue, we have the tint, we have the measure of the divine radiance. Wherever there is creature, wherever there is a manifestation, even your worst enemy carries this radiance. You know, the light shining within you, huh? Even the lousy snails that eat my garden have that radiance. This outpouring of this activity, becoming, at the same time, side by side with it, almost within it, you know, this outpouring, there is this ingoing, the ingoing movement. See, so we have the outward flow, the so-called downswing, which you will read once in a while in some books, and then this turning around, as it were, and the energy returning, and it carries all creatures back to the source. And he says further, it is this centripetal movement, the eternal return, that directs the active life of us all. It is the return movement that carries us. Now, Tagore, Rabindranath Tagore, he is the very highly esteemed poet of India. And he said at one time that our Western culture, the Christian world, is caught in and is mainly concerned with extending itself outward. We want to go out. We live in a world of extensions, you know. We developed a microscope and to see the tiniest, tiny, and a telescope to see the furthest that we possibly can. See, this is still, this extension is still this outward swing, downward swing, moving out. And in this moving out, it leaves untouched this inner consciousness, which is our true fulfillment. You know, it's nice when the psychologists of today say, well, you know, we should fulfill ourselves. So woman, you go have a child, and for the man, you go get yourself a better job so you're more secure and you will be fulfilled. So you write a book, write a poem, bake a cake, create something, be in this creative activity, and that's your fulfillment. What about the soul? What about that which is essentially you? What about this essence in you? To truly know this essence, this is your real fulfillment. The other is fine, and it's necessary. It's part of the personality, And each fulfillment is for the time being only. You know, you cannot tell a woman of 50, go have a child. and that's your fulfillment. No. She's past that stage. So our fulfillment comes in stages. Yeah. Each is for a time being. It's a thing of the moment. And after you bake a cake, you know, you're in this creative activity, you bake a cake, and after you've baked the cake, how long does it take before you've got to create something else? Not too long. Maybe 2 days. Huh? Now what? Now what are you going to do to create? Well, bake another cake. No, they'll bake a pie. Okay? See? And so then you begin to experiment with cakes and pies, and maybe you take them someplace and you win a prize, and pretty soon you've written a cookbook, and, you know, ego fulfillment. You fulfilled yourself. But then what? You know, the soul is still hungry. You've got to feed it, too. And then Tagore goes on to say of India and its partiality toward the inner world, you know, let all the material go. It's all nothing. It's all Maya. It means nothing. Just let me see Brahman. Brahman alone is real. This world is all illusory. Brahman alone is real. And this world is Brahman, huh? Oh, yeah, that's Ramana Maharshi used to say that all the time. Let me see the essence of the being. Let me see the essence of myself. And so India is immersed in an inner world and experiences outwardly poverty. There's no extension. Of course, they're trying to change, but... So, but we're immersed in an outer world, and we live in the material. And they're immersed in this inner world and have poverty, which is right. Which one? Uh-huh. Spiritually speaking, one should be balanced, huh? Within and without. So, you know, we live in this world. We work, we eat, and we sleep. And when we do that, we are a manifestation of that one. And we are also seeking that one within this many. And we pray, and we worship, and we abuse the very thing, whatever you want to call it, which brought us to this place. We don't pay any attention to it. And to look down our noses as working and eating and sleeping as non-essential, as not spiritual, that's certainly getting the cart before the horse. And most of you are familiar with the story of the enlightened monk. He's out there chopping stuff in the garden with his hoe, and this visitor comes to see him, and he says, now, what is the difference now in how you live as an enlightened man than before, you know? And this monk looks at him and he says, yeah, what do you mean? And he says, well, what do you do differently than you did before you were enlightened? And the monk looks at him and he says, well, before I was enlightened, I worked in the garden and I ate and I slept. And now that I'm enlightened, I work in the garden and I eat and I sleep. And the visitor says, there's no difference. Well, outwardly, no. Inwardly, yes. Inwardly, there's no me anymore doing the working. See, who is working? Who is eating? Who is sleeping? Who is sitting there? Who are you? And now we also have this word which is called wisdom. We have insight into manifestation, and we have insight into wisdom. Wisdom is not gathering information. There's something in us that knows. And I use the term know as the Greeks used it, you know, the nous, the mind, the nous, or the noesis. You know, one knows with a noetic quality, and sometimes we call that intuition. So what is this? This is, you know, mysterious. You have an insight. With what did you perceive that? What is this knowing that we have? And we all have it. It knows with no information, has no information whatsoever. It hasn't any words. We can't talk about it. If, for instance, you take the oyster, something brushes against, here's the oyster sitting under a rock in the water, and something brushes against it, and the oyster feels this sense of touch, something has brushed against it. The beginning of the use of senses, the sense of touch is the beginning. Consciousness is touched by something. And immediately, this oyster opens its shell, opens its mouth, like a baby bird, It sits there and waits for the water to flow through, and when it feels the water flowing through, and this thing is in it, booms, and it has something to eat. How does the oyster know how to do this? Who taught it? How does it know that it's got to open its shell? How does it know that it felt something? How does it know this? It doesn't have any brains. It can't think. But it knows it has to eat to survive. It knows it. What is it in that oyster that is so intelligent? We watch the birds, and we watch the cats and the dogs, and sometimes we're amazed with their intelligence. What is it in these expressions, you know, that knows? In nature, everywhere, there is this tremendous intelligence. And remember, we are part and parcel of this nature, so it is in us too. And we cover this tremendous intelligence with our minds, with our thinking, with our intellect, and we feel we are so smart. Well, we've got a lot of information, and that's true, and I'm certainly not against that. See, although from time to time I may sound like I am, but get all the information you can. Just go get it all. But do not let it cover over the intelligence in you. And do allow for some time each day to allow that intelligence to become wisdom. Yeah? How do you do that? Well, that's very simple, of course. You practice meditation so that this begins to stand out. You know, and you can see this intelligence, you know, at times. You can see it in the eye of a dog. You can see it in the eye of a bird. You know, the power sometimes that comes through is simply overwhelming. You know, intelligence is powerful. You know, and a rose and a tree and a dog and a cat and an owl and the darn crows, they all have it. You know? It's to be seen if you have the eyes to see. But you know, we see things with the senses, and then we make things and objects out of them. Put it all out there. I'm sure that somewhere along the line, and still maybe, you know, you observe yourself. And you have observed yourself enough to know that all kindness, all caring, all hating, all anything whatever rises in you. Hmm? It doesn't rise someplace else and then jump over and take possession. No, it rises, it comes up in us. Hmm? That how we have created the world in which we live, you know, how we taste and how we touch and how we emote and how we think, what prejudices we think with, and what beliefs we think with, you know. All of this comes up, and we can see it. It comes up for you to view, for you to look at, and you have an inner perception by which you can see your emotions. You have an inner perception by which you can see what you think. You can see inwardly your prejudice. You don't put it over there and go over here and stand and look at it. No, there it is. No, you've got it in here to see it. It comes up and you see it. With what do you see it? Hmm? Each of us has the ability to know himself. All the things that rise, and finally, the very thing that by which it has known all of these little things. Hmm? You know, the old adage in Delphi, in Greece, you know, over a cave, carved in the rock, man, know thyself in true proportion. Hmm? How else will you know anything about God? Hmm? Yeah. Oh, he's in the house. That's all right. Anyway, there's one little thing, and then we're going to finish here. Let's say there's a pond or there's a well, and the water is very still, and the night is very clear. And so we can see a star at the bottom of the well. Huh? And the child says, look, look, there's a star at the bottom of the well. And we say, oh yeah, that's a reflection. You know, it's like we somehow wipe away the wonder of it. But you haven't taken away the mystery, no matter how much your words try to cover it over. Reason, this mysterious reason, cannot be grasped intellectually. It can be looked at and cannot be seen. So we call it invisible, you know. You know that you're seeing it, this reason, this very moment. You are seeing it. You are seeing with it, and you are seeing it. But we don't see it directly. You know, and Jesus said, you know, you need the eyes, if you have eyes with which to see. It is not the senses, the sense receptors, by which you see it. We do not see it, so we call it invisible. Listen to and can't be heard. We call it then inaudible. Grasp for, but it can't be touched. So it's called intangible. And yet, when we meet it, you can see it, and you can hear it, and you can touch it. And Jesus said also, I will give you what the eye has not seen, and what the ear has not heard, and what the hand has not touched, and what has not arisen in the heart of man. Hmm? So what rises in the heart of man? Desire. Hmm? Something other than desire, he said, I will give you what the eye has not seen, what the hand has not touched, and what the ear has not heard, and what has not risen in your heart. And of course he spoke in the language of the culture of that time. But we should look at this, and we should take it into ourselves, and we should go within ourselves. we do not need to stand around with our mouths gaping, you know, and our eyes closed like baby birds. Did you see the picture of them the other night on TV? My God, it's awful. It's all they do. Yeah, right. Huh? We don't need to be like that. You know. And it seems sometimes we live in such a paucity of understanding. And at the same time, every now and then, there is a book. Or there's something on the radio. Or there's something on TV. And people are talking. And these great minds meet. And it leaves you breathless. Huh? With what people today do know, ontologically speaking. Yeah. We should join them. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding keep us and hold us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.